What does it mean to seek out the best of what has been thought and said in the world? To pursue the beautiful and the true? In Not Your Victim, How Our Obsession with Race Traps and Divides Us, Marie Cawthor Dowda makes a powerful case for embracing the past in all its complexity. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Marie, welcome to the EI podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to begin with the simple but profound question you pose at the very start of the book. Where are you really from?
Well, if I had to answer personally, it's already quite messed up. I come from Morocco. That would be the simple answer. I was born and raised there. I studied in France and moved to Britain, more particularly Oxford, some 8 years ago for work. But when we ask the question, where are you really from? It has become a sort of tricky question to ask, especially to people who do not look like your average Caucasian. So if you ask this question to someone who does look British, there's no issue at all. But as soon as you ask that question to someone who looks like they're not from here, it is meant to be seen as an aggression. So I opened the book with the statement that in fact this question is a lot more complex than it seems if we acknowledge the fact that we're all heirs to very complex histories, at times cross histories between different countries, different civilizations. And it's very hard to draw the line between the good guys and the bad guys in history. So in a way, everyone who is here comes from a civilization that has raped, pillaged, burnt, etc. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So it's an acknowledgement of the fact that the past is most of the times made of very messy pages, but if we rip these pages away, there's not much left in our history.
And a lot of your personal history is woven through the text. Is that part of the answer to that problem for you, that what we felt and known and encountered, and above all the things that have truly marked our experiences, how can you make that into a shared resource?
Well, the thing is that when I started asking myself about the place of history in the current culture, in the current political issues that are raised and discussed either in the student world or at large in politics, one thing that struck me is that the very question of how difficult it is to address the past becomes blurred because we tend to take it in two general lines, two broad lines. And I have the impression that my particular life, well, my ancestry, etc., made me particularly aware of the fact that, you know, other places have had empires, and these empires were far from being nicer or gentler than the French or the British Empire. So the reason why I talk about my personal experience a lot is that I know what it is like to be an immigrant. I have been an immigrant in France, then an immigrant in Britain. I know that this situation does come with prejudice. It does come with a valid reason to prove oneself, just to show, well, that the reason why we are here has to matter, and it has to bring something to the country. So I have faced these questions about, well, what brings you here? Why did you not study in your home country? You know, all these questions. And it's something that gave me, I'd say, sort of front seat to witness some of the big issues of the 2020 from a particular perspective, because as you'll probably remember, it was the year when all the statues had to be toppled, and the idea of toppling down these visible signs of British history was cemented by the thought that people like me, with a slightly different skin color or with an accent or with different ancestry, were meant to feel threatened and unsafe by these signs of the history that Britain has kept. And I really wanted to make a stance against that, because it is, in fact, the French culture that drew me to France, and then the British culture that drew me to Britain. And the reason for that can be seen in all the architectural traces, the public monuments, the way, the visible and invisible heritage shapes everyday life in these countries. And I think it is something that ought to be preserved and shared and hopefully transmitted to the next generations.
That iconoclasm in the contemporary West that you explore, and particularly the tearing down of statues, what does that phenomenon look like from your perspective, coming from North Africa, where there isn't the same tradition of public statues?
Well, my first encounter with iconoclasm personally was through the news when, it was during one of the several wars in the Middle East, and the Afghan regime was bombing Buddha statues of Buddha, which were incommensurable trace of the global heritage. And I think I was 12 or 13 there, and I was shaken to the core by the fact that there are these traces of history and they are being destroyed for religious reasons. So I come from Morocco, where Islam is perceived, well, it is practiced as an iconic religion. One thing that I discuss in the book is that other branches of Islamic thought are not that averse to figurative representations. But in Morocco, you don't have that many statues out there. So for me, the statues were most of the time, reproductions of Greek or Roman statues that I could find in books. Then later, when I traveled to France as a child, it was the statues of authors, kings, queens that I could see. And 12 or 13 year old me was utterly shocked to see that people who did have such an heritage around them wanted to destroy it. So moving forward to many decades later in 2020, I was surprised to see the same iconoclast trend going free through Britain, and not among people who were, I'd say, the least educated. It had become a sort of fashionable view that the statues that represented problematic historical figures had to be removed. And it shocked me all the more that Britain does have a complex history of iconoclasm, if you consider the wars of religion and how, well, the Civil War, for instance, was almost crystallized around ideas of, well, what statues can be kept, should we destroy all the statues? So the fact that Britain had already gone through that, in particular in England, and would bring back the same attitude, but towards figures of the late 19th, 20th century, I found that very surprising. And I thought something had to be said about the fact that these statues are not just, that they're not just ornamental, or they're not just there to praise someone. They're also erected as witnesses to what certain periods do consider as positive. So for instance, when it comes to the statues of people who were celebrated as benefactors, like Colston or Rhodes, they did not, their statues were not erected because they were considered universally good. People knew that these were complex characters, but they were celebrated as philanthropists, people who did good around them, and it was meant to be more of a behavioral pattern for the people who would look at these statues and be inspired to either to make donations to their college or to found hospitals and charities like Colston did. So fundamentally, when today, no one would bat an eyelid at a statue of Greta Thunberg being erected, because everyone talks about ecology, the climate, and how it's important to be aware of all these questions. It's not because Greta Thunberg is a perfect person, it is because she embodies these ideals. And if we are so judgmental about our past, we should also be ready to be judged quite severely by the next generations, who will think that our positions regarding certain matters can be at times quite silly.
So what would you say are the sort of defining features of this, what you call the kind of victim story? How does that play out as a way? Because I guess it's a way of, it's a blunt way of trying to deal with the past.
Yes, so the victimhood status has become the sort of a highest status position in our society, which is quite a turn from, I'd say, the more violent bullying society of the 80s. I think now, after political correctness became the norm, being a victim is a claim for power. So we have that very interesting inversion by which weakness becomes a means to acquire either status or a concrete form of authority around oneself or as a group. This is something that is only visible in Western countries. You wouldn't have any appraisal of victimhood culture in countries that have not been influenced by, I'd say, the post-Christian idea that to be a victim is to be right. And one thing that I find extremely interesting in terms of international politics and how the media, either legacy media or social media, portrays it, is that nowadays any victim is considered by default good. And the dynamic here is very interesting because it's not so much about the victims themselves or about the groups that are oppressed. It is about chastising an oppressor. So the oppressor becomes scapegoated in a way. And well, one thing that I found surprising too is the change, the inversion of status in terms of, well, what happened to white Western men during the last decades, they're being, well, first seen as the source of all evil and now being denied either, places in teaching institutions, in politics, etc., because of the idea that they already have too much advantage and that other groups should be prioritized. And this can sometimes be done at a very high cost. So the victimhood mentality, in fact, does not benefit the victims at all, because the only story that it tells is that if you do not belong to the allegedly superior class of white Western men, then your life is by default harder, and you should it and things should be made easier for you. So imagine the effect that that has on students, and we see it quite unfortunately in American universities, where standards are made quite different depending on students' skin colors. So you'd end up having students who keep on passing just because they do not belong to the average Caucasian type or whatever. So the problem is that it tells a lie, which is that these people, these communities, should always be nurtured and petted and, in a way, cannot make it on their own. It's as though there was always a need for the system to provide something a little extra for them because, they are so weak they can't do it. And the paradox is that this victimhood culture ends up perpetuating the same sort of racial cliches that we decry when we look at the late 19th century, all the ideas about other civilizations being either in the category of the noble savage. So, well, Africans don't have any civilization or any history. They just spring out from the earth and have this sort of inner knowledge of everything, or of Asian cultures being naturally in touch with something more spiritual, more mystical. So in a way, the most modern ways of dealing with multiculturalism end up, through the victimhood narrative, perpetuating exactly the same cliches as those that the entire 20th century has tried to challenge.
And part of the joy of the book actually is the way the chronological depth you take the reader right back to the roots of that story, and it goes back quite a long way in the history of Western thought. You suggest that the Renaissance and the Enlightenment were kind of pivotal. So I'd like to go back for you to take us back to Montaigne and when he began to question kind of Western assumptions. Do you think he could have imagined the relativism he may have inadvertently set in motion?
Well, I think Montaigne would have loved to live in our times and would have written some captivatingly cynical essays about the sickness of our period. And what I find fascinating about his writings, well, if we take one of his most fascinating and most famous essays, The Cannibal of Cannibals, he talks about that tribe describing their cannibalistic rituals. And at first, it sounds like he's just making a case for cultural relativism. Oh, well, these people, they behave that like that, and we too have our weird things. So maybe we'll just let them be. But in fact, if you read the essay until the end, it becomes an extremely severe attack on the society that he sees around him in France at the time of the wars between Catholics and Protestants. So the point that he makes is not just that, oh, well, there are people over there eating their enemies in a ritual way. So, well, this is one acceptable way of behaving. He brings that straight home quite literally and says that we do find their attitude revolting and shocking. And yet, when people who are allegedly civilized, are cultured, have benefited from all the long stream of culture and civilization that he's familiar with, kill each other in the name of religion, we consider that absolutely normal. So, in fact, it's not that relativist. He does have a firm stand that there are some things that are unacceptable, but he uses the example of the Topinambá tribe to talk about his own contemporaries as though they were a weird tribe devouring each other on the French territory. So in Montaigne's perspective, the idea that people in the West and in other places are different allows him to shape a form of universal humanity. Now, if you take that a little later, well, across the 17th century and land in the Enlightenment in the 18th century, this reflection about what actually makes humans have, well, what brings humanity together, becomes what we will know today as universalism, the idea that there is such a thing as mankind, as humanity, and that people are in a way, more or less the same everywhere. And one of the main proponents of this theory, or one of those who popularized it the most, is Rousseau with his general statements about humanity. So we're probably all familiar with the opening of the social contract, man was born free, and everywhere he's in chains. So for Rousseau, the idea is that every society ends up entrapping the ideal blank slate man and forces this imaginary character into doing things that are contrary to human nature. So for Rousseau, things like property, social hierarchies, and things like that are only the result of the evil in society, and we have to revert to an almost prelapsarian state in which everyone would be free to do exactly what they want. Now, the paradox is that Rousseau's idea was so powerful that it triggered the French Revolution. But if you look at the detail of the social contract, he does say that such a state has never existed, but he writes about it in such a poignant way that it would make the reader feel like we have lost a state that was absolutely perfect, and it is worth tearing down everything we have in order to return to this noble savage state and reconnect ourselves with a form of freedom that would make everyone happy.
Yeah, so I mean, where do you see echoes of that today? I mean, in education, for example, or in the way Western institutions talk about indigenous culture?
Well, both actually. I think Rousseau, paradoxically, is the great winner of modern French thought, or probably even Western thought. First, from the educational perspective, one of his most influential books was Émile ou de l'éducation, so it's a treatise on education, where he shapes the idea of child-led education. Now, I think it would be wonderful if every child could be educated like that individually, discovering the world one step at a time, sort of guided by a tutor who loosely applies the Socratic method. That sounds brilliant, but when you want to apply that to a classroom of 30 or 40 pupils or students, it doesn't work at all. And there's something utopian about wanting a schoolroom to work on a child-led position. So It has led, well, especially in the after the educational turn of the 60s and 70s, to the idea that the teacher is merely guiding the pupils instead of providing them with solid knowledge. So that's one of the real elements of influences of influence of Rousseau. And when it comes to the idea of oversimplifying non-Western cultures, yes, we do see that quite a lot. So as I said, in the book, I do discuss the question of Islam and aniconism, that in many Middle Eastern cultures, religious representations are actually not forbidden in Islam. So when you see that, well, quite recently in Britain, there was that whole kerfuffle about not allowing representations of the child Jesus in a school because this might offend Muslim students. That there's no solid reason for that apart from the fact that the cliche about Muslims is that they don't like figurative representations of religious figures. So the and symmetrically, when it comes to artistic education or music, there's that very weird idea that one has to be Western in order to appreciate Western art. But symmetrically, Western pupils are supposed to be absolutely open to anything non-Western. So it becomes a sort of a two-tier system where, because of the cliche of cultural appropriation, non-Westerners cannot really share their culture in a meaningful way, in a way that would make people participate in it. And Westerners cannot share the culture either because he's labeled as being oppressive or too uniform or whatever, which is entirely false. So it leads many schools to either simplify or entirely let go of their artistic curriculum with the idea that, well, it doesn't speak to everyone, therefore it's better to remove it altogether.
I think one of the most striking kind of elements of the text is your criticism of enlightenment. And I guess that's one of the cliches about the West that I imagine you want to take on, that the West is kind of coefficient with enlightenment's reign of reason. And I love the points in the book where you go back into medieval thought and look for creative solutions to some of these, shall we say, identity problems in pre-modern thought, that there's a kind of richer picture of the West out there that doesn't just move through the progressive system of Renaissance, Enlightenment, and so on.
Yes, absolutely. Well, one of the difficulties in Western culture that we have to face nowadays is that, for better and for worse, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment have been key moments in the shaping of our modern institutions as we know them. Now, the problem is that if you only read this part of the story, you let go of the fact that everything that has been acquired, established through these periods was already quite deeply rooted in the medieval period. So people say medieval in a simplistic way, forgetting that it is a little more than 1,000 years of thought, philosophy, architecture, and the Middle Ages are derided as this period where people were unclean, uneducated, incapable of being open to anything else than whatever the priest tells them to believe. This is absolutely false. So if we look, for instance, at the historical works that Rémy Brague, whom I quote, has made, the 12th century was a huge period of what we would call today, well, international collaboration with travelers going all around, well, from Europe to Asia to Africa, and being actually very aware of how other civilizations were dealing with matters of power, sovereignty, authority. So some figures in the Middle Ages were already ushering in the Renaissance period, so Abélard, Ockham, for instance. But when we look at them, we also forget all the groundwork that has been done by St. Thomas Aquinas, for instance, when it comes to establishing natural law, defining a connection between faith and reason, or establishing the what a just law should be and how a just ruler should apply them. So when we look at the institutional history of the Western world, it might appear that we owe everything to that period of the 18th century or the 16th century, but a lot more had been going on before. And we need to be aware of this continuity because, of course, one of the major things that happened through the Renaissance is that people became interested in what is called the secondary causes. So, if we consider for the medieval scholastics, the primary cause is divine. So everything is ordained by God. Everything has a cause in the invisible world. The Renaissance brought in the idea that, well, there are these primary causes, but there are also secondary causes. For instance, if there's a plague, maybe we could look into questions of sanitization, or if there is this or that disease, there might be a reason, well, why this could happen. So if we looked at this in terms of continuity, much more than separation between the eras of reason and the eras of faith, we would see that in fact they were deeply intertwined, and that it is this connection that makes the richness of Europe, of having had this continuity from the time of the cathedrals to the time of the top technology laboratories. So these are connected and take part in the same thirst for knowledge, truth, and meaning.
Yeah, and is the history of Britain a useful kind of counterexample to the French experience? And I know you talk in the book about, probably one of the most profound kind of clean breaks in English and British history, which is the Reformation and the dissolution of the monasteries. How does that case study, as a moment of kind of fracturing and also continuity, compare with the French example? The year zero moment, but also the continuities between Ancien Régime France and modern France.
That's a great question. If you look at, well, the question of the impact of the Reformation in England and in Britain at large, you'd already see that it is actually quite complex because, well, as soon as the Reformation happens in Europe, you do have people who are interested in it philosophically, theologically. In Britain, but with Henry VIII, you do have, on the one hand, the dissolution of the monasteries, but also, on the other hand, the Book of Common Prayer and the establishment of the Church of England, with everything that it did bring to this country. So I'd say the year zero of the dissolution of the monasteries in Britain, first, well, it happened a longer, well, it happened long ago in comparison with the relative freshness of the French Revolution. And we can see its consequences. So first, that you do have some traces that remain, so Tintern Abbey is not just a ruin, it's also a living poem that people still learn by heart. Walsingham too is one of these places that hold a trace of what had happened. I think today people have a much more nuanced connection to the dissolution of the monasteries and the end of Catholicism in England. However, there was also something new that has already become a tradition, largely because what I was mentioning, the Book of Common Prayer, a lot of it is derived from the monastic liturgies. So there is a lot more continuity than rupture than one would like to think. Now, if you compare that to the French example of the revolution, when Britain beheaded its king, Charles I, it had the smartness to get another king, while in France, the restoration after the dissolution of the Ancien Régime didn't work at all. And one of the reasons for that is that at the time of the revolution, unfortunately, well, it is undeniable that the aristocracy had lost its raison d'être. One of the explanations for that is that if you look at the original repetition of the orders, the first order was the clergy that were praying. The second order was the nobility, the aristocracy. They were meant to fight for everyone else. And the third order was the tiers état in charge of, well, doing absolutely all the rest. One thing that is often overlooked is that the French Revolution was not the deed of some very hungry peasants. It was largely the bourgeoisie who had the financial power and who wanted to acquire political legitimacy as well. And this couldn't happen without dismantling the privileges of the aristocracy. The problem is that by the end of the 18th century, the aristocracy in France was largely ornamental, and that is due to the large changes that Louis XIV introduced by separating the nobility from their estates, so having them spend more time in Disneyland, that is to say Versailles, than on their actual territory. So instead of being landlords in charge of their own of everyone else who was living on their land, they became gradually estranged from their own responsibilities. So one century later, you end up having the French Revolution because that, well, there was one reason for that, which is this disconnection between the aristocracy and their actual duties. So when you look at the things that Britain has managed to keep all through the 16th century, then all the changes of the 18th century, then even more deeply the constitutional changes of the 19th century, Britain has an incredible resilience in terms of maintaining some of its key institutions. So having, well, the House of Lords, for instance, is something that the French Restoration wanted to imitate, especially in its constitutional form, and it failed. It just didn't hold on. So one thing that I find rather sad nowadays is that Britain is shaking these key institutions that have been part of its resilience, part of its capacity to go through so many centuries, so many historical and cultural revolutions. And well, letting go of that might actually hinder its future.
It is striking in that story of the French Revolution how men of impeccable ancien régime credentials end up being administrators of the terror. And it's as if there's this kind of pathos about it as well, that the generations who come after the revolution are constantly trying to elaborate a vision of what's gone before. But they struggle to because it's always trying to create something new. And I think in Britain we've sort of managed to stay away from this. We haven't gone through that kind of historical process, which is really heartbreaking in France, that whole 70-year period after the revolution. I mean, you know 19th century French literature so well. It's like the themes of Les Misérables or The Count of Monte Cristo. It's all about this kind of, how do we handle the sins of the fathers? How do we surmount the past while trying to be always new and at the forefront of things?
Yeah, so it's very interesting that you mention Les Misérables and The Count of Monte Cristo, because both of these novels are actually written in the shadow of Napoleon. So Les Misérables begins with the return from the island of Elbe, and it's also the backdrop to the opening of The Count of Monte Cristo, where Edmond Dantès is entrapped in this conspiracy that he knows nothing about. So after, I'd say after the Ancien Régime, everyone in France was looking for a king. So as Napoleon said, he found the crown of France in the gutter. So he just picked it up. And if you look at how Carlyle sees Napoleon, there's something quite fascinating in this sort of a fascination rejection, the idea that one could be a great man without being a good man at all. But Napoleon did have that effect of uniting France again, and no matter what is to be held against it, all the gruesome wars of the beginning of the 19th century can be ascribed to the Napoleonic urge to conquer Europe. But he had a way of knowing each of his soldiers, even the most basic infantry guy. He could ask him about his family, his village. So there was something captivating about this figure. And after Napoleon, there hasn't been any great man in France. We had a bit of a spark again with General de Gaulle. But apart from that, I think the long succession of French republics. We're now at the fifth, and one may wonder if it's if we're not actually already in the sixth republic. We have all these changes of regime that wait for someone special to happen. So it's as though France is still waiting for a providential moment that somehow never comes. And as long as it doesn't have it, the very idea of French identity is in jeopardy because so much has happened that there is hardly any unity at all in the country at the moment. So that in a way, if Britain wants to have a look at its future, what could happen if all the institutions are dismantled? What happens if the social contract between different people is shattered? Well, look at France and you'd have a pretty grim picture of the future.
Well, I mean, just to come back to the core theme, I mean, there's a striking paradox in the book, I felt, that this Western guilt that you describe still behaves in an odd way as though it's the kind of dominant force within the politics of victimhood, that it's still the West is still the kind of apex predator within the hierarchy. Can you kind of explain a bit more why you think that's happened?
Well, I'm not sure about the why. I think many reasons can be given. One would be either in France or in Britain, the huge change in the population. So having to deal with mass immigration, being suddenly confronted with people who really do not have the same framework in terms of politics, ideology, whatever. I think it has had some consequence in terms of shaking up the solidity of the Western supremacy myth. But at the same time, as you are saying, things are still seen from a very Western perspective. So quite often when I have these conversations about the differences between cultures, someone would say, yes, but you are denying that other cultures too have brought wonderful things, or that this or that non-Western empire too had wonderful things. Well, I'm not denying it at all, but one thing to be noted is that in these other parts of the world, no one would raise to the battle to defend Western empire or the Western history. So it's quite interesting to see that there is both this very Western reaction to say that there are wonderful things out there in other cultures, in other civilizations that we ought to be open to and be aware of. And that's a very good thing. I think it's one of the most powerful things about Western culture, to be so open to other ideas. But at the same time, something that didn't exist before, which is a certain amount of self-deprecation. And I think that's largely due to the not only the lack of factual knowledge, but also the lack of a teaching that would take into account the emotional aspect of things. So other former empires know that they did have slaves and traded gold for slaves and did very, very bad things. But it's only in the West that you'd hear people talk, for instance, about reparations, doing something concrete to amend for the past. And I think that is, well, sort of, well, consequence of having post-Christianity, while having forgotten about Christianity. But also at the same time, it shows that there is something that is still radically Western about the idea of being the civilization that is in charge of discovering, sharing, and promoting. So many people would make fun of the mission civilisatrice, the civilizing mission that some proponents of the British or French Empire were discussing. But in a way, they still have this attitude, when they want to push on, I'd say, Western notions on the Middle East and in Africa, without taking into account the background and all the complexity of what people actually believe there. So that's yes, it's quite a paradox that there would be simultaneously a very Western attitude in terms of still believing that what is Western would be better for other cultures, and also at the same time a sort of radical respect for anything non-Western. Anything that is non-Western is good. And finally, the idea that if you are not Western, then you would automatically have something to share that is better than what the West has to offer.
You talk about the kind of post-religious element of this worldview. Do you think that's what triggers the search for the kind of relentless and restless search for emotional safety? And do you think that search can ever actually deliver the kind of safety people really want?
Well, the question of emotional safety is a very interesting one if you look at it in relation to the ideas of victimhood and guilt, because while we did talk a lot about this idea of victimhood, there's also a lot of performative guilt that is, in fact, the opposite of guilt. It is about putting the blame on one's forefathers. So, Ubu, the Victorians, were absolutely evil because they were colonizers, but we're not like them. We're so not like them that we're going to pay compensation, make amends. We're going to publicly take the knee to acknowledge that we have done dreadful things. So there's that sense that some bad things have happened in the past and we have to pay the price for them. I think that can be very harmful for young people who end up having no other notion of the past than the sort of heavy burden that cannot be shaken. But for many people, it's also a way to say, well, we are actually good. We are not guilty of the sins of our fathers. So there is something almost mythological about these moments. And I really like René Girard's way of relating times of crisis to times of scapegoating. So when there is a crisis, you'd have to find the scapegoat, and once the scapegoat is exterminated, then you can claim that you are clean again and you can have unity again until the next crisis, and you have to do it all over again. So we were talking earlier about how white Western men have become the sort of paradoxical scapegoat of the modern Western world. They were allegedly at the top, and now they have to be exterminated, or at least removed from the public spaces. But if you look at the consequence of that, it does lead to a lot of self-hatred, especially, well, if you think of white Western boys, either working class or not, there's a sense of being made into a foreigner in your own country, and that's something extremely harmful. And I think a lot of that explains the current political polarization. But if you look at the core of it, there is definitely a religious issue. It's a problem of meaning. It's a problem of having a framework to understand why evil happens. So in a secular worldview, evil happens because of socioeconomic circumstances, and socioeconomic circumstances could excuse anything. We have this very strange post-Jean Valjean attitude, as in, well, if someone has stolen something, it's not because they lack morality. It is because society made them so poor that they had no other means. So I think we should look at that very carefully, because an excuse is not a justification. You can explain some things, but it doesn't make them inherently right. And now we have reverted to a mode where being forced into doing something bad becomes a new way of being sacralized, and it can be very, very a very dangerous narrative to defend. So fundamentally, if we consider that evil happens for other reasons than socioeconomic circumstances, people will do bad things regardless of their skin color or whatever. The problem is much more complex, and it can at times be scary, because if your narrative is a Rousseau type of narrative that if people can do anything they want, they will be free and they will be happy and everyone will be perfect, you don't have any explanation for, well, what happens when someone does something bad with absolutely no reason, no extenuating circumstances. And that can be quite a ghastly thing to think about if you don't have any ideological framework. So many religions have tried to answer this question of the problem of evil, but the secular post-Rousseauian religion explains it by the socioeconomics, and therefore the only solution can be socioeconomical, and it deprives people of the real answers, the real spiritual food that could allow them to really think about the world around them and go beyond the dichotomy, evil people, doing things to poor oppressed people and see that, you know, poor oppressed people can do bad things too.
Yeah, and I think there's a straight line there from that the Rousseauian view to Robespierre. You know, virtue without terror is impotence. If you operate with this post-religious attitude and try and think through evil, you end up just worshipping power, because that's all life looks like, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Well, a contemporary of Robespierre was Le Marquis de Sade, and it's interesting to put Sade and Robespierre on one side and Rousseau on the other, because, well, Sade started as a constitutional monarchist, so in view of the whole revolution background, he was one of the solid moderate ones who just wanted a monarchy and the constitution. And then some mysterious thing happened in his life. He did some things that would really not go down well in the Me Too era, was sent to the Bastille much more for his political views than for his personal life. And that is when he started thinking and writing a lot about what happens once people are left to do exactly what they want. So there's a passage in La Philosophie dans le Boudoir, which is called a little more effort if you'd like to be Republicans. Français, encore un effort si vous voulez être républicain. And it's a wonderful slippery slope from, well, we need to grant people the freedom to do everything they want, to we need to grant people absolute sexual freedom, to we need to give people the right to murder, because after all, nature is murderous too. And he just takes the whole Republican idea of needing both equality and freedom and pushes it to its limits. And by the end of the essay, you end up thinking, well, maybe we should stop that whole revolution business, because this is not going to end well. So paradoxically, the author, who is represented as being one of the most efficient social destroyers, was keenly aware of the connection between Rousseau's dream of equality and freedom and the Robespierre consequence of, if you want both, the only people who will prevail will be the strongest. So it's very interesting to see how that played out, and how Sade, with his reputation as a pornographist, was in fact one of the most acute political commentators of his time.
Just to finish on maybe a more positive note, there's some absolutely wonderful passages in your book where you talk about the profundity and the kind of possibilities inherent in a serious engagement with the Western canon. You know, what are those possibilities for you, and what kind of advice would you give the younger generation who maybe aren't being explained the beauty and potential within this tradition? You know, how can they engage with it?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I think one of the sad things that we see today, either in schools or in higher education, is that books are reduced to politics, and that can be explained by the ethical turn of the 1980s. A book has to be morally good in order to be worthy of being read. And that led to a very strange way of reading books, which is much more of a permanent criticism. Well, oh, this character looks like he's a misogynist. Oh, this character looks like he doesn't think well of that other character for racial reasons and whatever. So you end up having a critical view of literature that is really not on on artistic grounds, but on ethical grounds. I'd say that the ethics of literature are entirely part of its beauty. Of course, when you read, well, I'm currently reading Mansfield Park, and of course you're supposed to be shocked by Mrs. Norris' selfishness. It's entirely part of the narrative. So explaining her away from the book, or saying you shouldn't read Mansfield Park because there are some bad characters in it, that would be taking the problem the other way around. So good authors use bad characters, immoral characters, to pull the guts of the reader from one page to another. And I had a literature professor who used to say that you can't make good literature with good sentiments. So the sentimentalist aspect, that every book has to be read in order to derive a direct, explicit moral knowledge from it. I think that's something that we need to step away from. So if, well, for the young listeners who'd like to know where to start, well, the beautiful thing about the canon is that every work in it throws you into another one. So still in Mansfield Park, there's a beautiful passage where Jane Austen says that we're all speaking Shakespeare, we're all using images, similes that he created himself. And if you look at Shakespeare, you'd want to have a look also at Ovid, or you'd want to look at history books that talk about all the Henrys of the history of England. So there is something wonderfully consistent about the canon, and just start wherever you want and bear in mind that the most celebrated authors who are now considered champions of post-colonial or decolonial thought were too steeped in the Western canon. So you wouldn't have Maya Angelou or Aimé Césaire without Shakespeare either.
Indeed. Well, thanks, Marie. That was fascinating. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.